dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man I've come to respect greatly for both his acumen about and his direct service in various aspects of that war is our first guest. He is, well, a Renaissance man, to say the least. I could call him Representative Brad Winstrup, or Dr. Brad Winstrup, or Colonel Brad Winstrup, reflecting his service both in the House of Representatives at the moment, where he serves on the Intelligence Committee, the Armed Services Committee, and the Veterans Affairs Committee. He chairs the latter's Subcommittee on Health. He's a medical doctor by training and has served in the Army Reserves, rising to the rank of colonel, and serving even as we speak in the Walter Reed National Military Medical Center in Bethesda to do his duty to his patients there. It's a great pleasure to have him back at a time when he's been making a little news, I think very important news, as a matter of fact, in connection with the investigation into the so-called Russian intervention in our election of 2016 in collusion with the Trump campaign, an allegation that, as far as I can tell, remains to be demonstrated. But Congressman Brad Winstrup, welcome back. It's so good to have you, and thank you for your service in all of these respects.
Thank you. It's an honor to serve this great country.
Well, I agree with you, and you do it with distinction. So let me talk to you about what you did this week in interrogating John Brennan, the former Central Intelligence Agency director, when he was before your committee. It was a very important moment, I think, in a number of respects, both for the initiative itself and the response you got. Tell us about it.
Well, I didn't have a pre-planned question necessarily going into the hearing. But when I heard a few things being discussed, it led to my line of questioning. One of the things that had been discussed with Mr. Himes and Mr. Brennan, Congressman Himes and Mr. Brennan, was the Russian playbook. And it was espoused that the Russian playbook that the intelligence community is concerned about is when Russians are reaching out to influential Americans and trying to build relationships there. And we also have known for decades and decades, going back to the Soviet Union, and this has been displayed many times, that the Russians have tried to interfere with our elections in many, many ways. And I think the important thing for us overall is that we engage that and try and prevent it in any way, shape, or form in the future and be focusing on that. But nonetheless, we're looking at current situations, obviously, but they talked about those things. And so I just thought it might be important to bring up that several years ago, a very influential American said to a Russian diplomat, he said, "This is my last election. And after my election, I have more flexibility." And the Russian diplomat said, "I understand. I'll transmit this information to Vladimir, and I stand with you."
Yeah, but the one other point that that person, of course, was Barack Obama, Brad, was that he said, "Ask Vladimir to give me some space," which seems to me to be a pretty direct appeal for Russian intervention in our election of 2012.
And what I was trying to get to is, you know, having Mr. Brennan take me through the process. And I gave him leverage in that. I admitted that he was not the CIA director at the time of that conversation, but I'm just curious, what is the actual type of conversation that sets up a red flag?
Yeah, where's that playbook?
Yeah. Right. Where did the playbook suddenly go? And when do you refer to law enforcement? And, you know, I really was hoping to get into more of a conversation. Well, did the policy change over time? Did it change while you were the director? We never really got to that point, unfortunately, as he refused to answer the question really at all.
To recognize the question, as he put it, which was even more stunning to me. Let me ask you about one other aspect of this, if I can. In that regard, there is, of course, a concern that among the things that went over the side in some of these transactions is what's been called the Russian Silicon Valley, something called Skolkovo. And I don't know if this has come to your attention, sir, or not, but it really warrants close look, because as an Army officer, I'm sure you'll appreciate that the United States Army said that this transaction, which was facilitated by, or series of transactions, which was facilitated by Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State, was tantamount to an overt technology theft operation by the Russians. And again, this seems to me to be in the sweet spot of the Intelligence Committee, if ever there were a topic.
Well, I think that what you're touching on is important. And again, going back to what I said earlier, Frank, is that we need to be concerned about all the activities of not just the Russians, but other adversaries. And we know we have a few that are trying to influence things in America and trying to disrupt our system. And that's an area we really need to focus on. And, you know, what we see happening today, as far as the Russian playbook, which is to interfere with America, right now, I'd say they're winning. It's been more like for them, it's heads I win and tails you lose. If they were able to diminish a President Hillary Clinton, that would be great, right? And that was their effort. But if she doesn't win, now they've set a message out to those that want to disparage Mr. Trump, that they can try and say it's illegitimate, which, of course, it is not, and his election, that is. And so I think they're in the driver's seat.
That's the Russian playbook, I'd say.
That's the Russian playbook.
Yeah.
And, you know, Frank, I'm all about the old Superman, right? It always began with truth, justice, and the American way. And I feel that trust is certainly slipping away, and I'm going to do everything I can to reestablish trust and not chase ghosts, but to get the facts and move our country along in a positive direction so we can be the beacon that it's always been in the world.
Well, we support you in that, needless to say. And our guest is Congressman Brad Winstrup. Let me ask you, as a member of the House Armed Services Committee, for a quick take, if you could, on the president's recommendations with respect to defense spending, Congressman. Are they adequate? Are they likely to be dead on arrival, as we've been told the budget more generally is, by the likes of no less than John McCain, the chairman of the counterpart committee?
And I mean, as you know, budgets are just a template. They are not law, and they are the driving point of conversation. And I think you're going to see the House ask for more and explain why. And as we met the other day, we think it's important that we don't just talk about dollars. We talk about capabilities. What capabilities are you willing to give up? What capabilities do you highlight as the most important? And why those capabilities are important in the world that we live in today, with the various threats that we face, not only from peer adversaries or near peer adversaries, but against the war on terror. So it's pretty complicated, and we're asking a lot of our military to handle a lot of situations.
Congressman, let me, before I let you go, ask you about one other area that you've been very active in your capacity as chairman of the Health Subcommittee of the Veterans Affairs Committee, and that is a raft of bills that have been introduced in the House and now, I believe, adopted in many cases to try to improve our treatment of our veterans to whom we owe so much. Could you give us just a quick overview of that?
Yeah, well, of course, the number one thing is get patients into care and get them to appropriate care in a timely fashion and as conveniently as possible. So that means sometimes it's within the walls of the VA, other times it's outside the walls of the VA. We're also trying to make it more simple for directors and for secretaries, the secretary, to get rid of bad actors within the VA. Bad actors in a workspace bring down morale tremendously. So,
and degrade service, needless to say.
Yes, it definitely does. It's not fair to those that have served us so well. And so we've got a lot on our plate, and it's an ambitious schedule. But I think the stars have lined up. You have me as a physician and a veteran as the subcommittee chair. Our House chairman is Dr. Phil Rowe, who's also a veteran and an OBGYN, another doctor. The secretary is a physician that came from the private sector. And we seem to have a president that gives a darn about us getting it right.
He sure does. I know you try, and I appreciate so much your coming to talk a little bit about it with us from time to time. I hope you'll do it again soon. In the meantime, Congressman Wenstrup, thank you for your service to our country this Memorial Day weekend. We celebrate you and those you have worked with and served so well. Keep it up. Come back to us, sir. Next up, we'll talk with George Raceley of Conservative HQ about the RINOs war on the Trump budget and more right after this.
Visit us at Facebook.com/SecureFreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined for the first time, I'm very pleased to say, though I regret that it's not been a more frequent encounter, because he's a friend and colleague, George Raceley. He is these days the managing editor of a terrific outlet, Conservative HQ, associated with the inimitable Richard Viguerie. George formerly worked on Vice President Dan Quayle's staff back in the H.W. Bush administration, and served on the staff of Congressman Mac Thornberry. These days he is, of course, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee. It's always a delight to have a chance to interact with him and to cover some of the things that George is writing about at Conservative HQ. George, good to have a chance to talk with you on air about it. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me, Frank. It's always great to have an opportunity to sell conservativehq.com and also to chat with you about the security challenges facing our country today.
Well, you're giving a lot of thought to them, and it's most appreciated both in your publications and elsewhere. And George, I wanted to talk about, first of all, something we discussed briefly a moment ago with Congressman Wenstrup, and that is what you've described as the RINOs war, that is to say, Republicans in name only, their war on the Trump conservative budget. Talk a little bit about who's at work there and to what end.
Well, the principal RINO that I would finger for that one is Senator John McCain. But, you know, there are plenty of others in the House as well. And frankly, it's the House and Senate leadership, Mitch McConnell in the Senate and Paul Ryan in the House, who have more or less said that Trump's budget is DOA and that
dead on arrival.
Yes. And they're not going to seriously consider his proposals for reducing the deficit and for getting us back into some kind of fiscal sanity.
Well, and rebuilding the defense budget and all the rest. There seems to be a growing probability, if not an absolute certainty, George, that there will no longer be appropriations in this process, that the budget will be enacted in whatever form it ultimately takes by some sort of continuing resolution mechanism or an omnibus or something like that. Describe, as a man who spent time on Capitol Hill, what the breakdown of that so-called regular order really means in terms of accountability and in terms of, well, the product as well.
Yeah, well, what happens, Frank, is it just leaves the government on autopilot. And so when we have these continuing resolutions, what House and Senate Republicans majorities are doing is essentially just continuing Obama's spending agenda. And so that's how, all of the spending on refugee resettlements just simply goes forward on autopilot.
Yeah, because essentially it just simply carries forward spending from the previous year at the same levels. And so unless there's some other kind of legislation, like a new appropriations bill that cuts funding or adds to a new adds in a new program. It's business as usual, I take it.
Absolutely. It's, you know, continuing resolution means just what it says. It just continues on as it was before.
And the permanent bureaucracy keeps running everything. Much of it put in place, let's be clear, by Barack Obama. Hey, speaking of Barack Obama, George, another essay that you've recently written made very pointed charges about the role of President Obama and then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in creating the failed state of Libya, which may have contributed, perhaps rather more directly than we know at the moment, to the kind of jihadism that we saw in Manchester last week and the United Kingdom. Develop that thought, if you would.
Well, yeah. I mean, Clinton and Obama made a conscious policy decision to back Islamist revolutionaries against secular governments in North Africa and the Near East. There were two parts of it. There was a public part, which I believe was referred to as 21st century statecraft, and then there was a top secret part, which was memorialized in a finding called PSD 11, Presidential Study Directive 11, in which Obama's State Department would leave the establishment of non-government organizations, as they call them, or revolutionary cells, as we might call them, to alter the internal politics in targeted states in North Africa and the Near East.
And specifically, that would mean essentially collaborating with the Muslim Brotherhood to effect its ascendancy instead of the relatively pro-American governments that they would be overthrowing. George, let me ask you about the sort of related point that in the midst of this mayhem in Britain, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in the United States handed down a very, very aggressive, shall we say, rebuke to President Trump over the idea of keeping people out, like this fellow, Salman Abedi, whose family had immigrated to the United Kingdom before he engaged in this kind of attack, and who had apparently just been in Libya himself for a month or so prior to it. Talk about, you know, what the consequences of that action by the court might be and whether it's off base, in your view.
Well, it's absolutely off base, and taken to its logical conclusion, it means that there is a right of anybody, any place in the world, to immigrate to the United States, and we can't keep them out. And so that is, you know, clearly not only unconstitutional, but outrageous on its face.
Yeah, I'd say insane, for want of a better term. It's crazy. Do you anticipate this will be reversed by the Supremes?
Well, I can only hope that it would be, but I mean, I've forgotten pretty much everything I learned in law school except for call your lawyer before you do it.
Well, it seems like the judges have too, as far as I can tell, at least if they learned anything about the Constitution in law school, but that's not necessarily the case any longer, is it?
No, but I mean, on its face, it overturns the President's Article 2 powers on national security and Congress's powers on immigration and Article 1 powers on immigration. So,
which they have delegated substantially to the president with respect to these kinds of issues of immigration. Let me ask you, George, about one other thing before we have to let you go very quickly. You've written a warning about the next version of the summer riots of 2016, arguing that they may be far better funded, far better organized, and far more dangerous here in 2017. Tell us why you think so.
Well, the far left has gotten a lot more money from George Soros and his fellow travelers. They now have an acknowledged fund of $80 million to coordinate this. That's more than twice as much as they had last year, according to my research. And important to recognize that while they always claim that these organizations are, you know, political, peaceful, 501c4s, the money for the violent and the pre-violent parts of these riots comes from the same place. They're all in it together. They all know each other. They all work together. They all communicate regularly.
They're all into resisting in whatever form it takes, sometimes very much of the violent kind. George, we'll be watching this closely, as I know will you at Conservative HQ. I'm very pleased to have you participating in our conversations about it, and I hope you'll do so regularly. Next up, Danielle Pletka joins us from the American Enterprise Institute. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it is a great pleasure to say we're joined by Danielle Pletka. She is the Senior Vice President for Foreign and Defense Policy at the American Enterprise Institute, a longtime professional staff member on the committee staff of the Foreign Relations Committee in the United States Senate, an active contributor, both in her own right and through her leadership at AEI, on a host of issues, and we're going to try to talk about a whole bunch of them here today. Particularly involving the Middle East and American interests there and the direction now of the Trump administration in that regard. Danny Pletka, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. It's been too long. I'm so glad to have you.
Thank you, Frank. It has been too long.
Well, speaking of the Middle East, of course, we're seeing the long arm of chaos in Libya apparently at work in Manchester, England. You have, in response to the attack there, written an important piece about the need not only to focus on the perpetrator and, you know, what his motivations and so on were, which is what everybody typically chases around doing, but also to go after the, as you put it, I think, the environment that breeds terrorism. And I'd like to ask you about that and what you mean by it and what we need to be doing to address it.
Thank you for asking. I wish more people would ask about this. You know, we, as a matter of counterterrorism and fighting ISIS and Al-Qaeda, the priority for governments has always been military options. And or in the case of the Obama administration, no military options and
no options.
Yeah. Right. And yet Barack Obama had one thing right, which is that there is no military solution to a lot of the challenges that we see from Islamist extremism. We have to start with the military, but where we move to from there is the big question. There's a lot of reluctance to do anything after. So let's talk about Mosul or Raqqa. We're looking at, you know, or even Libya. In each of these cases where there are efforts being made to oust the terrorists, those efforts, once they are concerted, are pretty successful. But what then? What we saw in 2011 when we withdrew from Iraq was, very shortly thereafter, because of bad governance, because of the then Prime Minister Maliki, we saw Al-Qaeda in Iraq resurface, morph into ISIS, and it is now causing problems for us all over the world. We need to address the environment.
How about the environment in the West itself, though, Danny? Are you concerned, as am I, about sort of the infrastructure that's built by the Muslim Brotherhood, it seems, predominantly, that conduces to, you know, the violence, the jihadism, and so on, even if they profess not to be violent themselves?
So, you know, there are a lot of different parts to this. And in Europe, what we see is that Muslim immigrant communities are ghettoized, and that these ghettos are actually swamps that feed a lot of terrorism. We also see a huge nexus between criminal activity and an attraction to terrorism. So we see that the European-born bombers in Paris, in Brussels, in the UK, all of these guys had a past as either drug users or criminals. So we see all of these nexuses. And again, we understand, whether it's the Muslim Brotherhood or it is Al-Qaeda or it is other Islamist extremist groups, is that they have gotten very good at exploiting these weaknesses in Western society and in it attracting young men who will go and blow themselves up at an Ariana Grande concert. we need to address that.
We do indeed. And, you know, one of the interesting things about that nexus you just drew between the criminal and the sort of jihadists is the degree to which in prisons, both there and here, I believe, there's a lot of incubating of this Sharia supremacism. So it's a huge problem, as you say. Speaking of which, the president was in Riyadh, as you know, last weekend, and spoke rather directly about this ideology of Islamic extremism. What did you make of the speech? Newt Gingrich has described it as a turning point, as have others. If so, in which direction do you think?
Look, I think it was a good speech, and I think that it was well considered. You know, the challenge for the United States and for President Trump is that expectations for us in the region among Sunni powers like Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates, like Egypt and others, are sky high. Why? Because, as one of my colleagues wrote, Jonah Goldberg wrote in the Los Angeles Times, because Donald Trump is president, not Barack Obama. And they are so consumed with their antipathy towards him and his Tehran first policies that they are now reposing. Obama's, yes, absolutely, not Donald Trump's, that they are reposing all of this hope in Donald Trump. He came, I think that he is, I think he understands that he can align with, galvanize the Sunni Muslim world, and actually create an alliance that hopefully can push back on Iran. So that is all to the good. I do think there are some inherent risks that need to be managed, but I think it's all to the good. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, I think it's mostly to the good, provided he holds them accountable to the driving out of the extremism, as he called for. It's important that they deal with us, with Iran. And I wanted to ask you as well about what your old committee, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, did just yesterday with respect to beginning a process of hopefully imposing some rather apparently important new sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran for the first time since this horrific deal was signed, or not signed, completed, shall we say.
Agreed to.
Agreed to, or not. Tell us what you make of these sanctions, and are they necessary, and what else should we be doing, Danny Pletka?
So, Frank, there are two sides of this for me. Number one is we don't need new sanctions authorities. In fact, the President of the United States has all the sanctions authorities he needs. So Donald Trump, much like Barack Obama, could have imposed under the International Emergency Economic Powers Act and a whole variety of nonproliferation statutes and a whole variety of Iran statutes, could have in fact imposed sanctions for the ballistic missile program, for Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps support for terrorism. Now, okay, so they didn't. So what does this legislation do? What this legislation does at the end of the day is it is message sending. Now, in the sense that Congress has gotten into the habit of doing almost nothing over the years, that is a good thing. But will it make the difference? No. Fundamentally, this is about the executive branch. This is about the president using the tools that are available to him, and more importantly still, persuading our allies who are going about business with Iran as if everything is just dandy, the Germans, the Chinese, the Koreans, the Japanese, the Italians, everybody. So it is about persuading all of them that if we don't do this, Iran is going to be such a danger, such a huge danger to our allies, to ourselves in the coming years, that we must preempt it.
Preempt is the interesting word here. I was struck by the fact that two of the principal architects of this bill, of course, the chairman and ranking member of the committee, Corker and Cardin, have presumably been discomfited by the fact that having essentially enabled this deal to get adopted formally, they are, I guess, having buyer's remorse, and it may actually leave us with few options but preemption in due course. Danny, before I let you go, and we're almost out of time, just very quickly, what are your thoughts on President Trump's efforts to breathe new life into the so-called peace process between the Arabs and specifically the Palestinians and Israel?
What a great question. You know, I don't know, actually, what to think. I can't figure out, honestly speaking, whether this is part of a big plan. So whether this is part of his efforts with Saudi Arabia and others to leverage a changed relationship between the Sunni Arabs and Israel that together will make a big difference against Iran, or whether this is the usual vanity that fuels a desire to get the Nobel Peace Prize by solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict once and for all. But saying that, the fundamentals haven't changed. You know, what do we need for peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians 50 years after the end of the Six-Day War? 50 years. What do we need? We need Palestinians who are a partner for the Israelis. There's no real obstacle to peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians other than the fact that the Palestinians are governed by a variety of crooks, criminals, and terrorists.
Listen, Danny, there's so much more to talk about. I hope you'll join us again to do so very soon. But thank you for this wonderful, very brief tour d'horizon of some of the issues in which you're expert. Again, we appreciate the work you do at the American Enterprise Institute and elsewhere. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Bill Gertz joins us next for our tour Inside the Ring. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. It's good to have with us, as we do each week at about this time, the man who writes his prize-winning column Inside the Ring and takes us on a tour thereof, as well as other spaces. He is, of course, Bill Gertz, the senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon, as well as the columnist at the Washington Times of that name. The author, most recently, now his seventh best-selling book, I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it's good to have you with us as always. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, I was talking earlier in the program with Congressman Brad Wenstrup about the appearance of John Brennan before the House Intelligence Committee earlier this week. You've written about it as well. What was your takeaway in terms of Brennan's testimony and the questions that arise therefrom?
Well, I think the big takeaway from the Brennan testimony was the fact that it was Brennan himself who recommended that the FBI begin this questionable counterintelligence probe into Russian influence in the election, specifically as it relates to whether or not the Trump campaign was colluding. It's significant because Brennan is one of the more politicized CIA directors. A lot of people don't really remember it, but he disclosed last year that when he was in college in 1976, he voted for Gus Hall, the Communist Party USA candidate. This was during the height of the Cold War. So that gives you a sense of his politics coming from the far left. So clearly, I would question his judgment about asking for this FBI probe, which again has been triggered all the way to a special counsel now.
Let me ask you, Bill, to switch gears here, to turn to one of your favorite topics and ours, China. You've got a number of pieces that you've put out this week. Let's start with a story that really goes to the heart of something that you've covered in your new book, I War. The Chinese apparently coercing the voice of America into effectively censoring some of its news reporting and communications. What's up with that?
Yeah, this is a major story that has gone unreported in most of the major news outlets, and it has to do with a Chinese billionaire who's basically in exile in the United States right now. His name is Wen Guo, Guo Wengui, and he is a former associate of the Vice Minister of State Security, who was imprisoned last year. And he has begun disclosing details about corruption among high-level Chinese officials, as well as MSS intelligence operations around the world, including in the United States. He arranged to begin to detail this in a three-hour Voice of America radio interview last month, and the Chinese began pressuring VOA not to do the interview, and it was cut off one
not to,
hour.
Not to broadcast it, I think you mean, right?
No, it was a live interview. They were doing it live. They did 1 hour and 19 minutes of the interview and then cut it off in midstream before he could get into the details.
So in this case, then, the VOA has apparently succumbed to the pressure, and this fellow's story, which has obviously considerable implications for what's going on in China, our national interests as well, is going untold. Bill, another example, I guess, of Chinese mastery of the I-war game.
Absolutely. The Chinese are masters at influence and political warfare. And the U.S. is totally unaware of it and just basically disarmed. As I recommend in IWAR, we've got to get better at conducting information operations and, more importantly, counter-information operations to deal with threats from China.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Bill, and your leadership on this has been huge and really appreciated. Let me ask you about some other things that the Chinese are up to that you've been reporting on, including renewed hostile air encounters against unarmed American aircraft in international airspace. First of all, tell us why our aircraft, the WC-135, was operating up near the Korean Peninsula and what the Chinese have done with respect to it.
Yeah, recently there was a hostile aerial intercept of one of our nuclear particle-sniffing aircraft. This is the WC-135, which is a specialized plane which has been conducting missions over the Korean Peninsula in an effort to monitor North Korea's nuclear program. The North Koreans last month were set to conduct their sixth nuclear test, which really heightened tensions, and the Trump administration leaned on the Chinese to prevent this from happening. Well, one of these aircraft that had come off the peninsula from a monitoring mission was intercepted by two Chinese Su-30s, one of whom did an extremely close pass to the aircraft in a threatening manner. Now, on the positive side, just this week, the Navy conducted the first freedom of navigation operation, which involved an exercise within 12 nautical miles of the Mischief Reef in the South China Sea, which is a very good sign.
This seems to be breaking somewhat new ground, certainly for the first time under the Trump administration. Bill, remind us what Mischief Reef is and why it's important for us to be asserting the right of free passage in its waters.
Yeah, this is really significant. The Chinese are building up military facilities on key reefs in the Spratly's Island chains. Mischief Reef is one of the closest to the Philippines, and it's very close to where the U.S. military will be deploying forces in order to maintain the freedom of that strategic waterway, which sees $5 trillion annually in trade pass through it. In the recent freedom of navigation operation, it was a little different, and it was not just innocent passage. The ship didn't just pass through it, but it actually conducted an operation within 12 nautical miles of this reef. The reef is, again, it was just a little outcropping of area, and it's been built up with a military-length runway, deep port facility, apparently some missile emplacements there. So this is a big confrontation with the Chinese. And of course, Beijing reacted harshly, called it a violation of China's sovereignty. But by successfully conducting this operation, doing this man overboard drill, the U.S. Navy, for the first time, has declared that this is not China's territory. It has a lot of legal standing under international law.
Let me ask you, Bill, what is the latest on the THAAD missile deployment in South Korea? I know the Chinese are pressing harshly against both the government there and the new government, which is trying to make nice with the North, but also the company that has made the land available for the deployment. I believe it's called the Lotte Company. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the deployment is going ahead. It hasn't been put on hold. Leftists within South Korea have been very active in protesting against this missile defense system, which is totally crazy since it's a purely defensive system. And yet this shows you how the left has driven the political and defense narrative, not just in South Korea, but around the world, that they can somehow challenge a defensive deployment. The new government of Moon Jae-in is somewhat hesitant about it, although the initial indications are it doesn't appear that he's going to reverse it, although that could change depending on the kind of leftist political pressure that's applied on him to try and reverse the decision to pull out the THAAD system.
Bill, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your time, as well as the great work that you do at the Washington Free Beacon and, of course, the Washington Times. Congratulations once again on War and Peace in the Information Age. I commend it to all of our listeners. Hope you'll check it out. Bill, I wish you and all of our listeners a very significant and blessed Memorial Day, and that we use it to reflect upon what the service of so many men and women have done to make this country both great and free and secure. Bless you all. We'll talk with you again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney. Thank you.